Go ahead and stay in the book of Habakkuk, and I'd like for us to look at that last verse that Davis just read for us. As we look at this, it's very much a proclamation of faith. God is the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on the high places. Were you and I just to read that verse, we might have a very different view of the book of Habakkuk. We might think, well, here is a writer who is giving this grand testimony of faith, and he is. However, what we find in this last verse is a completion of a journey. And in his short book, he takes us on that journey with him, starting out and showing us where he began, and then how he built the kind of faith that would bring him to be able to make such a proclamation as this. The little book of Habakkuk is kind of nestled in the minor prophets to the extent that many times it's overlooked. It perhaps is not viewed as having the deep theological ramifications that other books of the minor prophets might have. And just by its very length, it's sometimes easy just to give it a skim and go. But if we do that, that's a shame for us. Because God has put the book of Habakkuk there for a reason. And in his book, though it is not dealing with some of the other themes we might find, it is very much dealing with the kind of reactions that mankind has when bad times occur. When it looks like you are standing all by yourself, and that being with the Lord not being there either, to have that kind of feeling, God says, I want you to read about a man's journey. And I want you to see how that this man had the kind of solid bedrock faith that brought him to be able to trust in me even in the darkest of times. So this morning, I'd like for us to spend a few minutes talking about Habakkuk's journey, to see how this man grew in his faith, to understand how this man sets the example for us as he takes his journey through these dark times in his life. Let's begin over in chapter 1. And as we look here, we see that Habakkuk is very much in a low place. As the book opens, he shows us right away the difficulties that he's having in his life. And verse 2 points that out for us when he says, in crying to the Lord, O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence, and you will not save. Here is a man who hates sin, which is the first point we need to see in being the kind of man of faith that Habakkuk was. And so as he looks around at his society, he says, I've got two major problems. The first one is, why are you ignoring sin, Lord? All of this wickedness going on, all of this difficulty that I see around me, and you are just sitting back and you're not taking any action. I've cried out to you about it and you don't hear my prayer. And he goes on and he says, not only do I have a problem because of that, he says, I also have a problem with this group of people who are supposed to belong to the Lord, who supposedly are in a covenant relationship with him, and look at how they're behaving themselves. Look at how they're acting. I think many times when we study Habakkuk, we miss a point in here because we immediately start comparing it to our society, which we'll talk about in just a second. But that's not really a fair comparison. When you and I consider the United States of America, we are considering a group of people who, because of events that happened over a couple of hundred years ago, came together as a nation. Habakkuk's dealing with the people who are supposedly God's covenant people. And here, as he looks around them, he sees all of this wickedness, and he begins to describe the society that he lives in. He gives us three couplets here. The first one, he says, I look around me, and there's iniquity and wrong. And he says, and I keep on looking around me, and there's destruction, and there's violence. And I keep on looking around me, and there's strife, and there's contention. You and I need not try to go in and pinpoint different meanings in all of these words, though they would be there. What Habakkuk is doing is giving us a composite of where he lived. He said, I want you to see the kind of world that I'm living in. I want you to see the kind of life that my fellow countrymen, the people of God, are living. And I want you to see what God is ignoring, or at least that's what Habakkuk thought. But he doesn't stop there. He says not only the iniquity and the wrong and the destruction and the violence and the strife and the contention are there. He goes on to say, and when I look at the law of God, it's unable to do anything. It's paralyzed. Here are people who are supposed to be committed to those Sinai principles. Here are people who are supposed to be behaving themselves by the Ten Commandments, that foundational law. But yet as I look at the society in which I'm living, here are people who are doing nothing along those lines. And because of that, he says, justice, he first says, justice does not go out. And then he comes back and he says, well, it goes out, but it's perverted. It's a perversion of what God desired. Now, you're getting a feeling for his life. You understand why he's in this dark place. Why, as he looks around, he's seeing all of these things. Well, point number one, he hates sin. And I want us to understand that not only from Habakkuk's standpoint, but as we begin looking at this as a man who sets a worthy example for us, we need to understand, so should we. One of the things that's going to get us to the place in faith that we need to be is to have that same hatred that Habakkuk had for wickedness. I want to take you to a New Testament passage, which I think blends so well with what we're talking about this morning. In 1 John chapter 3 and verse 4, John writes, everyone who makes a practice of sinning also practices lawlessness. Sin is lawlessness. Now, if you go back and you read those descriptive words and read about the perversion of justice and law, the law in particular being paralyzed, I think we see a very striking comparison here. John says, if you are a child of God, if you are someone who is interested in higher things, you need to understand exactly what Habakkuk understood. That when sin is present, lawlessness is in existence. Now, as we think about that specifically concerning our own lives, and we understand the idea of needing to have that hatred of sin, we need to understand that on three levels. We need to understand it, first of all, on a very personal level. That's where it begins. That when we think about each of us individually, think about our lives and our attitudes, we need to take a good hard look at how we really think about sin. We go back to the psalmist who tells us quite clearly how we need to think about this. In Psalm 97:10, he says, O you who love the Lord, hate evil. You can't get much clearer than that, can you? He says the two things, God and sin, cannot be side by side. You cannot have a weak attitude toward sin and a strong attitude toward God. It's not that, but yet many times that's our temptation. To think, well, sin is not that bad. To think that I'm involved in just a few things, dabble in just a few things, it's not that big a deal. You know, if I let a word go now and again, or I'm kind of prone to gossip or anything like that, that's not a big deal. It is a big deal. And the psalmist says to us that if we are a people who love the Lord, that hatred of sin must be as present in our lives as it was in the life of Habakkuk. Now, let's go a step further. As we mentioned a minute ago, with our own society, we need to hate sin on a societal level. That as we look at the world around us, as we look at our fellow countrymen, as we look at the status of the world in general, and as we see what wickedness does, we need to hate that. We need to have strong opposition to the things that our world is now telling us is quite okay, even though the Bible says quite differently. Again, we go to the wisdom literature and we see this point being made. We think about what Solomon told us in Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 34. He says, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. No nation gets stronger as they get more corrupt and wicked. No nation is going to find itself having those same solid foundational pillars that hold us up in wickedness as it does in righteousness. And that's what the writer here is saying to us. But I want to look at a third thing that ties in very much with what we think about with Habakkuk. We also need to have a hatred of sin when it comes to the breaking of the covenant with God. The nation of Israel had a covenant with Jehovah, which they were not showing any loyalty to it in the days of Habakkuk. You and I think about that not as a physical nation, but as God's people. A nation that has said, we want to be a part of this people of God. We want God to be our God. And when we see sin encroaching in that area, then we need to be troubled by it. I want to go back to 1 John and finish the passage that we looked at earlier. As we go down to verse 7, John, as he does in 1 John, puts it very much in black and white terms. He says, little children, let no one deceive you. Whoever practices righteousness is righteous, as he is righteous. Whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil, for the devil has been sinning from the beginning. Now let's skip down to the next line in red, where he says, by this is evident who are the children of God and who are the children of the devil. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God. We have to understand that when it comes to our relationship in Christ. There are times in the lives of every one of us who are Christians where we are tempted to go astray, where we are tempted to walk in the ways of unrighteousness. And what God says is, you need to have a concern for each other in those occasions. When you have your fellow believers acting like people of the world, people practicing sin, you need to take very strong action there. You need to admonish and encourage to do better. Why? Because as the people of Israel were to be loyal to that covenant they had made with Jehovah, you and I also, as Christians, need to be loyal to that covenant that we have also made with Jehovah. And thus, as we think about all of these points, we have to understand that sin is a mockery of the things of God. And that was Habakkuk's problem. As he looked around and as he saw all that was going on, he says, God is being mocked by all of this, and yet it doesn't appear that he's doing anything about it. And that's what troubled him. And thus, a righteous people want to see righteousness restored. So how does Habakkuk begin his journey? He begins it as a man who hated sin. But we're not going to stop there, because we find that Habakkuk had a very strong relationship with God, which I think comes out so clearly within the book. In fact, if we look back to verse 2, we find those questions that he asked. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, cry out violence, and you do nothing? And God answers him. It's kind of rare in the Scriptures to find the kind of exchange we have going on between Habakkuk and the Lord. And I think that's what's one of the things that makes this book so unique and so beneficial for our study, because not only do we get a picture into the mind of Habakkuk, we get a very good picture into the mind of God. And if you look down to verse 5, going on down through verse 11, God says, Habakkuk, I am quite aware of what's happening here. I know exactly what's happening, and they are not going to get away with it. My people have sinned, and I am raising up the Chaldeans, this bitter and hasty nation, who are going to come in like predators, like evening wolves, like leopards, like eagles. And they are going to take action, and they are going to live in houses that they didn't build. You remember who else was told that one time? As Israel went into Canaan, God said, you're going to live in houses you didn't build. And now he says the Chaldeans are going to do that because they're going to take your land. He says they are going to treat you like sand. You remember that? God told Abraham, you'll have descendants like the sand of the seashore. Here God says the Babylonians are going to treat you as worthless sand. God says, I've got the situation under control, Habakkuk. But as we think about this, I want us to think about how Habakkuk responds to that. He doesn't like the answer that he gets. God has laid it out. He says, I know, I hear, I'm going to answer. I've come out, I've measured. But Habakkuk says to the Lord, I know what you're doing. But why are you going to let a people who are worse than us, take us over. Here are people who make no pretense of following you. Their God is their strength. They're like fishermen who come out and they catch their enemy in the net and then they worship the nets. They're idolaters. They're pagans. Why are you letting this happen? Now, what I want us to pay particular attention to in this section is this. Why does God allow Habakkuk to talk to him like this? You ever wondered that? As you've read through this short book, here is Habakkuk. He says, Lord, I want an answer. He gets an answer. He says, Lord, I don't like that answer. Why does God allow that? Well, I think that goes to a very great length in explaining to us just what kind of man Habakkuk is. And so as we look at this exchange, Habakkuk's relationship is built on the respect that he has for the Lord. I want you to look in chapter 1 and verse 12. Before Habakkuk expresses his dismay with God's answer, listen to what he says. He says, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. When we look at those words, something comes out to us markedly about Habakkuk's attitude. First of all, he says, I recognize you for who you are. Never underestimate the use of the word eternal when it comes to God. Because the writer or the speaker is saying to us, I understand there is a huge difference between you and me, between the infinite and the finite. And that's exactly what Habakkuk is saying here. I recognize who you are. I recognize your eternal nature. And he says, I recognize your holiness, that though I have said you have not listened, and though I question the way you're doing this, I understand that you stand out because of your purity. And he goes on to say, I recognize that your will be accomplished. Now, when Habakkuk uses the language that he does, it is built on this foundation. He's not coming to God as though God is some unfair, unworthy creature who is putting us through all kinds of pain and misery. He comes to Him as a man of humility, saying, I know you're eternal, I know you're holy, and I know that your good will be accomplished. Now, with that being said, when we look throughout the Bible, people of faith always talk plainly with God. I think we're a little intimidated by that point, because as we look at some of the language, we think, well, how could someone speak to God like that? Yet I think about Moses. Moses said, Lord, don't kill these people. They're going to all call you liars if you do that. We think about David, how many times, Psalm 22 being example of that, where he says, why, O Lord, why are you letting these things happen? Oh, and I tell you, you open that up to the other psalmist and they're asking why and how and telling the Lord to wake up and why are you ignoring me? Well, how do these men speak like that? Well, here's what we have to note. Their language is one where they're seeking to align their thoughts with the ways of God. Job was a very good man, but you know, God wasn't too pleased with the way Job talked to him. And at the end of the book presents that powerful speech where Job repents and he says, I have said things I shouldn't. What's the difference? Job's language was that of accusation. Though he didn't cross the ultimate line, there was this accusatory tone. But what we find with men of great faith in other occasions is where they're saying to the Lord, I don't understand the way this looks. It looks completely wrong to me, but I understand something about you. Do any of us have any doubt that Moses was a man of great faith? Do any of us have any doubt that David was and the psalmist were? No. And that's why God patiently answers these questions that Habakkuk is giving him. It's not that Habakkuk is being disrespectful. In fact, it's just the opposite, in that he wants to have the ultimate respect for God and to understand how that can occur. And that needs to be the case with us as well. You and I need to have that same kind of faith that's going to produce within us the confidence that God does indeed care about me. I think about what Peter told us when he says, "Humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God so that at the proper time He may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on Him because He cares for you." That's what we have to understand. That's a bedrock of faith. That we honestly believe that whatever situation we're in, however much another human might try to minimize it, that for us it is a big deal, that for us it is a great test, that for us it is something that's causing us difficulties, that God cares about that. And though He is great and holy and pure and eternal and awesome, He cares about me. And He cares about what's going on in my life. Let's make a point, though. God's not going to answer us as He did Habakkuk. He's not going to have this verbal exchange with us. I was talking to a young lady one time who had lost her faith. And she told me about the night when she realized her faith was gone. She said, "I sat on my bed and I prayed all night long, asking God just to give me a sign, just give me some kind of answer here." It's not how God's going to do it. But that doesn't need to cause us any alarm. That doesn't need cause us to believe that God doesn't care for me as He did for Habakkuk. Because God will hear and He will act rightly. Isn't that what Peter's telling us? But Peter also says something else. He says that's going to come only if we approach Him in the right way. That if we approach Him in humility, believing that He cares, He'll hear us. And He'll act in His own good way. We may be like Habakkuk. We may not fully appreciate the answer that we get at the time, but we fully appreciate God. Look back to chapter 2 of Habakkuk, verse 1. After he goes through this exchange, he says, "I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what He will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint." I trust Him. I'll take my stand. I've made my plea, and I'll watch for the Lord to act in His good time. And if we can do that, we can have that same kind of relationship that Habakkuk had with his Lord. And when we have that kind of relationship, we can then trust that God is going to make a way. We may not see any way possible that He's going to do that. Habakkuk sure didn't. Habakkuk looked at what he said about the people of God, and then he heard what he said about Babylon, and that scared him. But God says to Habakkuk, "I have this all under control." I want us to note just the few verses that follow here in verse 2 and 3. "The Lord answered me, 'Write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay.'" God says, "Habakkuk, you may not understand what's going on, but write it down on a tablet and stand watch because it's coming. My answers will be fulfilled." And thus God goes on to say, "I've got Babylon under control." And throughout chapter 2, beginning about verse 6 on down, he begins this series of woe to him, woe to him. And he describes the Chaldeans. He describes this wicked nation. And he says, "What they have done to others, they will get their retribution. While I have raised them up as an instrument of judgment against my people, I'll raise up another as an instrument of judgment against them." Yet, I believe the main point that we need to see in this is what God says to Habakkuk in verse 4. He says, "Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not right within him," talking about the enemy of God, "but the righteous shall live." Now stop right there. The righteous shall live. If we're not awfully careful, we would look at Habakkuk as kind of a negative book, as a book under a dark cloud of judgment. I'm not so sure that's the point we need to take away from it. I believe what we find in this book is God saying, even though there may be lots of darkness, Habakkuk, with me there is always life. There is always opportunity. There is always the ability to live. And he goes ahead further, "But the righteous shall live by his faith." You ever noticed how many times the New Testament writers quote that verse? The Apostle Paul, as he writes to the Romans and to the Galatians and what we find in the Hebrew letter, this idea is brought because this is God. Where there is God, there is life. Where one has faith in God, one finds life. In fact, a really interesting part of the book of Habakkuk is the third chapter, which is not so much the storyline anymore, but the inclusion of a psalm that Habakkuk writes on these ideas, and probably a psalm that was used by other Jews like him as worship during the time after Israel had been punished, but before the Babylonians had. And so within this psalm, he expands on this idea of the Lord in chapter 2 and verse 4. And he says, "I understand that the wicked will be punished." Verses 3 through 7 of chapter 3 are going to tell us that. But then he goes on to say, "But I also understand that the righteous will find salvation." Look at verse 13 of chapter 3. He says, "You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck." With God there is life, but with God there's also death. The decision is which side we stand on. God said, "For those who oppose me and my ways, surely death will come. But for those who follow me and obey me, there is life, there is salvation." And Habakkuk understood that. And thus he goes on and he says, "Here's how I build my faith." And thus at the end of chapter 3, he says in verse 16, "I know, I've got it, Lord. I know the reality that's about to happen, and so my body trembles and my lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters my bones, my legs tremble beneath me. Yet I'll quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us." He says, "I got that. And I've also got the fact that this is going to involve loss." Verse 17 on first blush makes it sound kind of like a famine or a drought, but it's not that. This is the spoil of war that's occurring here. "Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herds in the stalls, I recognize what's coming. Like that storm cloud that's rolling in, I know the loss that's going to come." But then he says, "I'm resolved that I trust in you." And he says, picking up in verse 18, "I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation." God, the Lord, Jehovah, the God of the covenant, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. And that's how men of faith trust. That though his world is literally crumbling around him, he says, "When I look to God, I can stand on the mountain, sure-footed, and understand that the Lord will provide." Now the question for me is my faith up to that standard? And I imagine all of us, as we look at our lives, may do a little proverbial scratching of the head here and say, I'm not there. So how do we get there? We get there the same way Habakkuk did. And it's trusting God. You see, trust is not just some platitude that we talk about. Trust is not some kind of fuzzy word that we throw into sermons. Trust is real and concrete. And it's there or it's not. And when you and I can have the kind of faith that says, whatever's going on around me, whatever's happening in my life personally, whatever's happening in society collectively, God's in control. I may not know His ways, I may not like His answers, but I know they're right. And because of that, I trust. And when we can do that, we too can have those feet of the deer to stand firm on the mountain no matter what's going on around us.